listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is the Motley Fool Money Mailbag.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, our very special, always very special, even though it's an hour later in some states at the moment, Motley Fool Money Mailbag episode. I'm Scott Phillips from The Motley Fool. He is Andrew Ram Page of strawman.com. Mr. Page, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Mate, very, very well. Thank you. And your good self?
No complaints. Good. No complaints. Life is good.
Are there fewer complaints now you're not renting? Is that part of why?
Yes. Yes.
How's the stress level?
It's much lower. It hasn't really hit yet. I think it'll take a good year or so. I was saying to you the other day, it's sort of like glass half full, glass half empty. There's one thing that you do miss, at least in theory. I know in practice it was never like this and was one of the many things I shook my fists at the sky at. But at least I was thinking, like, when things go wrong, at least you could pick up the phone and say, the oven's broken, this is broken. And in theory, it would come out and get fixed. Now, it doesn't work that way most of the time. But
the idea is it's someone else's problem, right?
It's someone else's problem. It's like when one of my downpipes had a slide issue, and I said to you the other day, everything was otherwise fine, but it was like, no, I've got to fix that. So there's always something to be pessimistic on.
There is. Have you managed to find another target for your hatred, for your disdain, or are you still on the old ones? What's the
no? I think so. Well, I think I have to hold on to the old ones because otherwise, it means that the frustration was all just about me. Which I don't want to admit.
Correct.
So I have to, like, you know, keep the fire in the belly. Because I actually made the comment to my wife the other day. It's like so many things that when they're in your orbit, you're just like, how is everyone not outraged about this?
That's actually true.
You know, and then someone will rant at you about another really legitimate problem, but it's not a problem that, you know, you might currently face. And even though you can intellectually sort of grasp, because, that sounds like a really bad situation, like, you know, those who know, and there's one thing to sort of whinge about the state of the hospital system or whatever it is, but when you're stuck in these systems, it is the worst thing. And, like, count your lucky stars if you're not, but I guess the point being is, like, even though there's one monkey off my back, so to speak, it's still an outrage, right? So I'm happy to lend my voice in whatever small way it can be lent to sort of fight for the rights of renters, because it's a terrible situation.
And your right to party. So it's important to fight for your right to party. Beastie Boys would be disappointed if we didn't have that one in.
That's exactly
right. Best of Random 80s reference for everyone, kids.
Liked it.
Yes.
Took me a bit to get to, but
yeah,
I'm with
sorry,
you.
Mate. Yeah. Obscure.
Like the Beastie Boys.
Yes, no, they're very, very good. Hey, should we just get into some questions?
Yeah, let's dive on in.
What I like about this question from, do we have a name? We do, Jake, who, he's suggesting we are football players of some repute. He says, hello, line-breaking forward Scotty Phils and rampaging playmaker Ando Page. There's a bit of a...
Ando. Do you like it? Well, actually, that's all my school era friends call me Ando.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, nice. There you go.
I think
known by many names.
Exactly. It's important. Yeah. But as many personalities possibly, I'm not sure.
Yeah,
is Ando different to Andrew?
Look, it's one of those things. It's like with Ram. I mean, you were the one who started that, right? Someone says it once and then it just kind of sticks. And so it's whether you like it or not, it's kind of like, all right.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it.
And, you know, particularly with certain friends, like the more you push back on a name.
Oh, yeah. Don't do that.
There's a friend of mine once who his name was Trevor, and he just sort of jokingly said, you know, you got to call me T-Bone from now on. My name's T-Bone. He was just joking around. But he mixed it up once and said teabag, and so forevermore, refer to him as teabag. It was like, and the more he complains about it, the more he's like, yeah, okay, teabag.
That one moment in time that you just wish you could take back. Yes,
exactly. It's stuck. It's set in stone.
I like it. All right. So from Jake to Ando, I think I have one quick and one complex question, he says, for the pod machine. I like the pod machine, Ando. How do you weight companies in terms of them being either core, growth, or speculative? Is this just off their market cap? And if so, what would the figure be for each? Now, I will give some background here. This is, I assume Jake's a share advisor member, although he was just lucky. We've had a thing at the Motley Fool we've called the portfolio pyramid. Mm. And the idea is the lower levels, the kind of foundation levels, are core. you kind of, you know, you have a core for your portfolio, add some growth, and then if you want to, you kind of add some, a little bit of speculation at the top if you need a little bit of spice on the very top of your pyramid. So that's, I assume, where it's come from, given that you've used those three terms. You may not have, so I don't want to assume, but I think that's probably where it's come from. Do you want to have a stab at that just conceptually, mate, or do you want me to just answer from a service perspective?
Yeah, no, I mean, it makes sense, right? There's, what matters is the portfolio overall, the average total returns.
Yeah.
I mean, however that's sort of achieved is kind of secondary, but obviously every individual component is what gives you that end result. So you're right to sort of think about how you layer that up in terms of things that might be considered much safer and things that might be a little bit spicier. Mm-hmm. There's no hard rules though to that.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think where it goes wrong is that people take it too literally or infer risk too directly through things like volatility and the rest of it. Yeah. So I've said to you many times, I reckon if you gave my portfolio to any expert, they would say it's highly speculative. And they would probably say it was highly speculative based on the market cap mix and sector concentration and all of these kinds
of
things.
Exactly. Yeah.
I would argue, maybe I'm wrong, but I would argue it's just like, well, they might be small, but I don't think they're that speculative. I'd say they're less speculative than many of stocks in the top 100 in a lot of ways. So Jake, sorry, was it Jake?
Jake,
I think, it's something worth thinking about and where you have that slider, but I wouldn't measure it on market cap just in reference to the point you made. It's got more to do with, someone said in a recent question we got, defined it in the way that Buffett defined it, which was the risk of permanent loss of capital is what you've got to look at. That's the risk, you know, that I don't get back my money at the very least, or I don't get the adequate return commensurate with the risks that I'm taking. How you measure that is an individual kind of thing, but you know, there, as I've said, things, when you really look at things critically, a lot of sacred truths get turned on their head. Like, you could argue that bonds were the safest investment instrument, but they've been a terrible investment over recent years. So do I still think in terms of core and that? I guess I do, because although I might define those things differently, I would say that the bigger weightings in my portfolio are absolutely those that I have a higher conviction on, and I would call them core. I don't know if others would define them by core through another lens, but to me, their core is just sort of like, it's far more impactful what, I don't want to name certain companies, but you know, this company does. I'd have a company that's I've got something in there at the moment that's 20%, and I got something in there that's like 2%. And sort of like, so by definition, one is more core than the other. But it wasn't necessarily designed that way, other than it's just a sort of a natural consequence of having the better ideas, the more what you perceive as the better risk-adjusted return potential investments as the larger componentry of it. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense, mate.
I don't go, 50% core and I've got 20%, exactly, you know, speculative or whatever the definitions are.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. This Jake, in my mind, so we have used it for share advisor, but I'll talk more broadly because I don't really want to talk about services. Not that I mind, but it's just not relevant to everybody. When you're building a portfolio, there's two ways to think about things like core and speculative, not so much growth. I'll come back to that. Because there's kind of the idea, and Andrew mentioned the top 100 of the speculative ideas. There's the share price potential and there's the company quality quality is probably the best word, actually. So you think about it, and for me, that's kind of how I think about core, right? Core isn't just low growth, because growth is the alternative. It's not a case of, you know, every company must fit in here. And that's the first thing. So not every company is one of those three things. What's a company I don't have much interest in? Don't know. I'll leave it alone. Whitehaven Coal, right? Is it core growth or speculative? None. I mean, if I was forced to buy it, I guess it would be speculative because I wouldn't consider it core or growth. But I wouldn't put it in. It's not a recommendation. I don't have my portfolio. It's none of those things. So we don't label or rank every company in the ASX and then choose from them. But when we make a recommendation, we tend to say, right, here's kind of where it might fit in your portfolio pyramid. And core for me is longer, more established businesses, generally larger businesses, generally with better quality balance sheets. Mm. Generally not as high growth potential because it's just more mature businesses. So, you know, they don't fit growth almost because
that's the trade-off, right?
Right.
You can't have all of those things. And well, I've got to be careful here because there's very glaring exceptions to that rule recently, but generally speaking, that's the compromise, right?
Exactly. So that's how we kind of, and for me, that's kind of the idea of core is just, Andrew's point's right. You can have an entirely speculative portfolio, and if you play the odds properly, you can still get a fantastic return or a woeful return. The reality is for most people, that's not a good way to invest because the chances you're right are unknowable. The chances you're right for the wrong reasons are also possible and also unknowable. But you know, you might be right for the wrong reasons or wrong for the right reasons. And jeopardizing your portfolio to play odds that are less certain is not a smart idea in my view, which is why speculative is a tiny part of the portfolio. In fact, we say 0 to 10% when we do it at the Fool. I don't think you need to speculate at all. You don't need to. I don't think you should. Well, most people shouldn't. I can't tell you what you should do, Jake, of course, but generally there's enough money to be made in core and growth. You don't need to speculate for the sake of it, right? It's a lot of ticket stuff. Don't do it.
Yeah. I just don't. I would go further and say, okay, I just don't speculate at all. I mean, right, look, exactly. I've got to be careful. It's all speculation. Yes. Even if he's just got a lump of gold under the mattress, right? There's a speculative dimension.
Oh, I mean, Woolies shares are speculative because, you know, it's a very known, knowable business, but maybe the business goes away tomorrow. Maybe there's a massive fraud. Maybe, you know, government's nationalizing to break it up.
It's an implicit bet on the future.
Yes, exactly.
Like it has to be. But acknowledging that, I would still say there is a line you cross at which there are investments that are based on hope, and then there are investments based on solid reasoning and some, at least some partial evidence that your view is being borne out. And so, okay, it might be small, it might be illiquid, it might be volatile, but if underneath all of that there is a real company producing real profits, exactly, demonstrating real growth, then yeah, okay, that could all end tomorrow. Yes. But that is a world away from a company that just discovered something in a test tube and in one day in 10 years would like to commercialize it.
So,
so, you know, and I would say I don't have any speculative investments, zero speculative investments. Like there are some that require... you know, there's a higher degree of difficulty perhaps, and maybe there are more things that can go wrong. But
That's right.
Who knows how I'm tricking myself, and I'm sure I'm tricking myself in 100 ways, but at least I'm not knowingly trying to this could be good, and if it's good, it'll be fantastic.
You're not playing moonshot territory stuff.
I spoke to David Williams the other day, the chairman of Innovic. He's also the chairman of PolyNovo, which is a fascinating company, by the way. Innovic's a far smaller company, $20, $30 million. They're doing some stuff with things called exosomes to basically detect cancers via blood tests. And they're super cool stuff, right? Are they going to be successful? I don't know. He doesn't know, right? No one knows. Is the potential for that technology further along than it was 3 years ago, even last year? Yeah, definitely. Are there still a lot of hurdles to go through to see some dollars at the end? Yeah, absolutely. What does Woolies have to do to make sure that it's getting some profit next year? Well, it just has to keep doing what it's doing. It doesn't have to do anything different. So there's a continuum along those two points there. And if ever you're getting into the realm where it's just sort of like, I've only really got goodwill and faith and hope that this will go well, but I've really got no concrete reasoning behind it, then that's speculation. And you should do zero of that, I would say, unless it's purely for fun and you know that you're just gambling.
And still don't do it.
And still don't do it.
Yeah. For me, the core and growth are actually, Charlie Munger was famed as saying that value and growth were joined at the hip.
Yeah,
because growth is a proportion is a component of value and vice versa.
Yep.
I would say the same with core and growth, quite honestly, Jake. I don't own any core companies that I don't think are going to be market beaters, and I'm not going to buy bad companies just to fill a box. Equally with growth, some of my core companies aren't going to grow. Sol Pat's about as core as they come. I've talked about it a million times. I like it a lot. It's beaten the market over the last 5, 10, and 20 years, and it's growing. That's how it's doing it, right? So growth to me is probably, if you think about the risk spectrum, the growth sector is, hey, I'm going to pay up a little bit more probably for something that's got some good growth potential, knowing that if that growth potential doesn't eventuate, I'm going to have paid too much. So it's kind of that's what growth investing kind of is. It's you know, it's saying, well, at some point in the future, I think this business could be multiple times its size, and if I pay this price, that should be a pretty good price. I was going to mention a company that I laugh because I'm going to mention Kogan Drink. It's growth. It's not a cool business. It only has just started making money. It needs to grow, justify the current market cap. If it doesn't grow, it's even at $8, it's come up a lot, it's come down a lot, it's still too expensive. So that is a really good example of a growth company because it's not core. It hasn't got a rock solid balance sheet. It hasn't got a long history of profitability. It hasn't got a brand that everyone knows and loves and will love in 25 years necessarily. I hope so, but you can't rely on it. So, you know, it fits in that growth thing for me. Again, though, just to finish off, we don't start with every company must be one of these three and therefore choose one. And that's why there is no cutoff at a market cap level. In fact, it's not market cap at all. It's absolutely size, solidity. It tends to be larger companies are probably more solid just because they have a bigger balance sheet and probably have more of a chance to have a second and third go at things. Smaller companies with smaller balance sheets tend to kind of, you know, if they screw up plan A, most of them won't have a chance at plan B. And that's okay. But that's kind of, it tends to be the case that quality businesses, you'd rather have I'd rather have a quality business with a large balance sheet than a quality business with a small balance sheet, right? All things being equal, because why wouldn't you? That's kind of for me. It's a qualitative factor, mate, rather than a market cap factor.
It definitely is. I mean, think about it in another way. So here's a company. I won't tell you the name. It came up when I was on AusBiz the other day. They're earning the same sales on a per share basis as they were 10 years ago.
Oh, wow.
They've paid a dividend in most years, but they had to miss a few years, and that dividend has been all over the place. Sometimes it's franked, sometimes it's not. The shares outstanding have doubled over that period. There's at least three or four periods within the last 10 years where they made a statutory loss. And yet, it's a $25 billion company and the largest energy company in Australia, I think, or one of. Can you guess which one it is? They all could potentially fit the mold, right?
AGL?
Santos.
Oh, okay. So, okay. I was thinking energy as in energy retailer, but yes, okay.
Now again, speak to your to your traditional analyst the mainstream, and they're going to tell you that is core.
Yeah.
It's a major energy producer. It's huge. It's extraordinarily liquid. Mm-hmm. It's a rubbish investment. Again, I just don't know why I'm having to justify some of the things I hold. And, you know, oh, that's pretty speculative. But, you know, I'm smart nation building companies. Like, no. It's been such a woeful investment. You could have held that thing. In fact, if you'd bought it 10 years ago, you're down. It got to actually $16 a share in 2007, and it's half that today. And even if you'd held it way back into the 90s and stuff, like the average return is less than a bank account. It's like, who's being speculative here in buying Santos shares? Well, I know it's been a rubbish pit of an investment for the last few decades, but now it's going to be really good. You know, and they're a commodity producer. They're massively capital intensive. It's a nonsense. This I really sticks in my craw, obviously, as you can tell. This delineation between what is investable and what's not, just because something is big. There's plenty of big, disgusting companies, and there's plenty of small, beautiful companies. And just think deeper about it.
That was the quick question.
Yes.
Let's go to Jake's complex question.
Oh, God.
How? Speaking of complex, we might need a timer on this podcast. How do you calculate, asks Jake, the intrinsic value of a company? See, easy question. Do you think this is even useful? I've watched a few takes on this, and there are different opinions and hard to know who to trust. If this is too long for the podcast, would you be able to point me in the direction of a trustworthy take on the process? As always, many thanks for the great podcast. Makes me look forward to my Monday morning commute to work. Thanks, Jake. That's very, very kind. Intrinsic value. How do you do it, and is it useful?
He's obviously got a long commute to work. I'm glad we could help fill the time. It's massively useful. I mean, it's so sort of everything. If I could know the one thing, if you could say you'd only know one thing about a company before you invest in it, I would say I would want to know its true intrinsic value.
Right, right.
Saying that, there is no such thing because no one can know. I mean, you can define it very precisely, but you can't ever really know it because it is implicit on projecting what a company will do in the future. But it's worth thinking about because I would flip it around and say, well, if not that, then what? How can you possibly buy something and say it's cheap with a straight face if you don't know what its true or more accurate reflection of its value is? You know what I mean? It's like it makes zero sense. So you've got to at least try to do it. And because we've said many times, you can do very badly in a wonderful business. Mm-hmm. You can easily overpay. CSL came up actually on the telly the other day, and it's like, do I like CSL? Yes, I do. I like it a lot. I put it as one of the top 10 businesses on the ASX, right? It's a phenomenal business. I would love to own huge amounts of it. Do I? No, I don't. More and more I'm getting tempted, but it's just been a terrible investment in recent years. Why? Yeah. Well, the company, you know, some of the growth came out of it. There's a COVID, and there's a few sort of factors that sort of in there, but nothing life-changing. The outlook's as bright as it ever was, but the share price was way too high. And that's the risk you take when you turn a blind eye to valuation. So how do you do it is there are various schools of thought and there's a thousand different takes on it, but you've got to at least try and, I think, independently frame it, because you're just shooting in you, I don't know what the proper metaphor is. You're just flailing in the breeze here, because your only signal is the market price. And you find yourself in this intellectual conundrum where it's just like, either the market price is always right, in which case whatever I buy is just going to give me the average return,
yeah, yeah.
Or it's wrong. But if it's wrong, how do I know it's wrong unless I've been able to independently assess what the actual value is, or what I think is the actual value?
Yeah, it's
that,
a really good
does
point.
That make sense?
No, it's a lovely point. So, Jake, in terms of how do you calculate it, there's some maths you should be able to Google the maths behind intrinsic value calculation. Effectively, you're trying to forecast future earnings or cash flows, and then you're discounting those cash flows or earnings back to the present day, because a dollar in 10 years' time is worth less than a dollar today. That's the kind of two broad structural parts of what you're trying to do. So, you know, if I have to wait 10 years for a dollar, how much would I pay for that? Well, I wouldn't pay a dollar. Now I get a dollar back in 10 years' time. Why would I bother? I'll get the dollar. If I could pay 10 cents and get a dollar in 5 years' time, I'd do that. I'd do it every day of the week. Somewhere in between those two numbers is the point on which you'd say that's enough. Now, companies, you've got growth in profits, not just a fixed dollar amount, and they're unknowable. So a 10 cent, $1 thing is easy, because they're knowable amounts of money, notwithstanding Ram's desperately going to talk about inflation at some point, as I mentioned this. but at least nominally, the values are knowable. And so look, the math is it takes a little bit to get your head around if you're not mathematically inclined, but it's not hard, particularly if you find a way. I don't have a resource on tap, honestly, to explain it, but it's out there and doable. Is it useful? I'm gonna mostly agree with Ram, other than to say it depends on how you invest. I work with Motley Fool co-founder David Gardner. I'm sure never done an intrinsic value calculation in his life. He is a growth investor. We talk about growth just then. He would say, I think NVIDIA is going to be 10 times the size in 5 years' time. And I think that's, you know, if that happens, today's price is pretty good. Without saying, I think NVIDIA today is worth this much based on that calculation. It's the same kind of idea. It's why I mentioned before about, not deliberately actually, Munger's thing about value and growth being joined at the hip, because growth is a function of value. And if you don't value anything, what's the growth worth? If NVIDIA goes up tenfold in size, it may be still too expensive right now, because the PE might simply be too high. So again, even if the growth guys get it right, doesn't mean they'll get the value right. Similarly, the value guys can do a calculation to a fifth decimal place, but they're never going to get the earnings growths 100% right. They could be up by miles, in which case they could be as wrong as the growth guys. So for me, usefulness, I don't do it as much as I used to. Once you've done a lot of it, you can kind of become a bit second nature in terms of broad ranges. And again, because Ram said
before, you can use heuristics, can't you?
Exactly. We're roughly right rather than precisely wrong if we are right. And so you kind of go, okay, well, you can kind of use roughly a PE and a growth rate and kind of back your way into it a little bit. Again, sometimes earnings and cash flow are different, so people do different things. I think what I have done more recently, if I'm doing it, is I do what I call reverse discounted cash flow analysis. Discounted cash flow, intrinsic value are the same thing effectively. It gets you to the same place, different ways of describing the same process. And I'm just asking myself, what does the market imply based on the current price the company will do?
If the market is right.
Correct.
What's the discount rate?
Yes.
So you're solving for a different variable.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so you just turn it backwards. Mm-hmm. And that means I don't necessarily always say, I think it's worth $1.50 a share. But I would say the market thinks that it can only grow at 5% a year based on the current price. I think it'll grow at 10% a year. There's probably going to be some good upside from that if I'm right.
Yep.
And it's exactly the same process. Why I'm saying once you do it enough times, do it, absolutely, to Ram's point. Do it because it shows you the variables. Do it because it makes you think about discount rates and earnings growth. Do it because it makes you understand the company better. And then once you've done it and done it and done it and done it, eventually you'll stop doing it. But as you say, you kind of back into it with heuristics and kind of get to the same sort of place.
Actually, I'll just elaborate a bit on that too. You want to beware of false precision and over-engineering these things. It what you learn about these models is that they're very hypersensitive. So you and I could have broadly the same assumptions, but you'll say, well, I'm going to use a 9% discount rate because of X, Y, and Z. And I'm going to say, well, I demand a higher one. And our valuations could differ significantly. Yep. and where we've really not changed too much in terms of our assumptions. So you realize that, and we tend to think the more work I do, the bigger I build out my model, the more variables I put into it. I'm trying to get to earnings growth here, but I'm going to think about sales and margins and growth in R&D and dividends, and I'm going to layer it all in. I actually think it's a very worthwhile exercise for the, as you say, for forcing you to think about these things. Yes. But you see it a lot in the professional class where they have such beautiful models that they forget that it is a model. It's not reality, right? And they forget the sensitivity to it. So I've really evolved to a very simplistic valuation. And I say evolved, I've gotten on backwards. And I think that's the thing to be aware of as you go into this. Definitely get the grounding, do all the hard work, know the models and that. But then once you've come through all of that process, you can come out the other side and go, well, really, this is the thing that kind of matters. And if this is broadly right, then I only need to, you know, I only really need to settle on some vague notion of roughly what growth is like. How does that look in the context? You know, and it's, what am I, there could be some small cap now that's at 5 cents, right? And it might be that it's got this big potential. And if it's right, it could be $2-3 a share in 5 years' time. If it's wrong, exactly. It could be 1 cent or 2 cents a share.
Yeah.
So if that's the truth, then, well, that's the range I'm dealing with. You know, if I buy it at 10 cents or 8 cents or 6 cents or 12 cents, I mean, you don't need that high. You're going to do really well if it does half of what you think it's going to do. And equally, you're still going to lose, you know, whether you're losing 80% or 63%, it's not the outcome that you kind of want. So
that's a really good point.
And I know the danger is not so much in over-egging the pudding and, you know, expecting these really great things and they don't come to fruition. But it can be the other thing where it's just like you're too conservative in that. And I have not invested in some of my favorite companies for forever because I've looked at it, it needs to be cheaper. You know, I demand this. I am Andrew Page. I demand this price and I shall not grant you my capital. And I was like, because it's too expensive because I think it, you know. And it's like, well, just the market's never given me that chance again. And you watch there from the sidelines waiting for you to get to a value that you don't. So you just sometimes you, what are we going to say? You put a pin on it. It matters, but don't get too carried away with your own mathematical ability.
Yes.
And generally right as opposed to specifically wrong.
Very nice. Trent sent us a question and said, "G'day boys, I really enjoy listening to the Pod Machine." So well done on that front. Again, Ram. As a bit of a snapshot and a couple of questions. Sorry, Ram, we do own a few properties, but we only started investing in the share market a few months before the crash in 2020. What a ride, he says. And continued investing and dollar cost averaging straight through that period. We own about 20 companies. Most of your everlasting income recommendations, Scott, thank you, as I subscribe, and a lot of recommendations from ShareAdvisor. Jeez, you want a discount on your membership this, right, Trent? He says, it's a low six-figure portfolio outside super, which we've done to build our family income quicker than inflation erodes it, and hopefully bridge that gap between late 50s and retirement if we want to slow down a little. My wife and I are currently in our early to mid 40s. At the moment, we put money aside and dollar cost average buying every few weeks, and all dividends go straight back into building the portfolio and will do for another 10 to 15 years. Well done. We also have a self-managed super fund that has just paid off a large land holding that gets leased out and creates a small income. Nice. He said it's worth $800,000 to $900,000, but we need to start building a share portfolio within this self-managed super. I wasn't sure whether to mirror our current portfolio or maybe Vanguard ETFs. Maybe NASDAQ 100, starting from scratch within our SMSF. I know you can't give personal advice, but just looking for a general direction at our age. He's got a second question. We'll stop there for a sec. This is kind of the super versus personal portfolio and whether there should be a different or similar strategy across those two different structures. What do you recommend? Is there a case for saying your best ideas are your best ideas, or is there a case for saying, well, it's super, you've got different time frames, different restrictions, different tax treatments, maybe you should do something a bit different?
I'm in the camp of your best idea is your best idea. Super, the only difference with super is you can't touch it and you get tax advantages.
Yeah.
And so you might have a bias towards things that are longer term in nature. Or things that for whatever reason you feel as though you want to move in and out, which would probably be counterproductive. But if you wanted to do that, you're not going to suffer the tax consequences along the way. But Yeah, I'm in the process. I think we discussed the other day of setting up a self-managed super fund. I want to much more align that with what's outside of super. And the reason for me setting one up is because I feel as though I'm too restricted in what I can do at this point in time. I don't want different for the sake of different. I want the same. It's a different pot of money. I can't touch it now. My best ideas I'm already invested in over here. Well, just why aren't I doing it there? And I want to do it there, and then just, you know, I'll take the benefits of the structure. But the best idea is the best idea.
Yeah, nicely put. By the way, the super conversation is next week. So listeners who are wondering whether you missed the episode, you didn't. We're just recording out of sequence. I'm going away next week.
And it's all a blur.
When we record that way, we always try and do the current episodes, if you like, late. So on the usual schedule, we kind of pre-record the ones that are happening next week. So yesterday we sat down and talked about next week's episodes. So you'll hear a bit about, there's a bit of a tease. Should you or shouldn't you have an SMSF? What should you consider? Andrew and I go into that in some surprising different ways. It was. I think I agree with you, Ram. With the only rider that the personal portfolio has been set up correctly. And I know that sounds obvious, and I don't mean that the slightest way to have a dig at Trent, but it's one of those, you know, I've got a portfolio full of specky stocks. I'm going to do the same with my super because basically it's my best idea. That's kind of true if those specky stocks are genuinely going to turn out for you, but, you know, just have a think. Yeah. Some people maybe, and I don't love this at all, but some people say, well, I'll put my proper investing in my super and I'll have my play money be my personal account. I wouldn't do that either, but some people do. And if that's your case, we're not saying take a bad strategy and do it in both places. Not that you are, Trent. I'm just saying that, you know, the only time it would be different for mine, I'm with Ram entirely. Your best idea is your best idea. My super fund and my personal account are, I think, almost entirely overlapping. There might be one company in each that isn't in the other for just different reasons, largely due to time I bought them, actually, when I had cash. Yeah. And I wouldn't try and make it the same for the sake of it, by the way. I wouldn't go out of your way to say, well, there's 30% of that in that account, yes, 20% in the other, or hopefully 2 or 3%, or I've got to buy them both at the same time, or worry about you bought one earlier so the price has gone up. You can mess with your head a little bit that way. But your best idea is, if you've got cash, more often than not, I would suspect you should be buying the same company at the same time in both accounts. If you've got cash in both accounts, then it's your best idea.
And it's not any extra work too, because you're already keeping track of the portfolio. So that's not. I mean, there would be an argument to say, and we often throw this as a variable in there, like how much work are you prepared to do? And there's no foul, no harm, no shame if you're just like, I couldn't be bothered. Okay, great, do an index and passively invest and life will be good.
Nice.
But you're doing the work anyway, right? And presumably you're not doing the Vanguard ETF outside of super because you feel as though you're going to get a better result there relative to the effort that you need to put in to do it. And you and me are doing the same thing, right? So that's our contention. And if that's our contention, then why not
do it. Yeah, exactly.
No extra work.
I mean, look, you know, again, think about personalities. So that's the rational answer, Trent. If yourself and your wife, you're saying, well, actually, we don't want super to be as volatile as our portfolio. We feel better if we know that it's invested differently. Or, you know, if you have different psychological approaches to super that suit you, then by all means, do it differently if you want to. You know, if you're of a view, look, I don't mind my personal account being volatile, but if my super was that volatile, I'd worry about retirement and I wouldn't sleep at night, then yeah, do some things differently if that's kind of what you want to do. But no need to from an investing perspective in our view.
Yeah.
His second question, mate, he says, our three kids, 6, 8 and 11, all have share portfolios. We are trying to build good habits and have a 20-20-60 approach. 20% save for a rainy day, 20% invest, and 60% do whatever you want with. They've all asked for chores that they get a small income from, and to talk to them about why we invest, we're keeping it very simple. We've only invested in ETFs, the Vanguard International ETF and the NASDAQ 100 ETF for them, but would you recommend further diversification or maybe some growth stocks? Our 11-year-old hit 11K, nice, in their share portfolio. Again, just looking for some general advice for the kids. I'll drop in first and foremost, Ram, only because your 20-20-60 trend is almost exactly the same as I'm doing with my young bloke. We're doing, this is not it feels like I'm going to say yours is wrong and mine's better, but we actually do 10-10-20-60, which sounds more complex. So 60% spend, 20% save for something big. We don't sort of say rainy day, but if you're saving up for something that you can't, you know, use, you might get, I don't know, 10 bucks for this or 20 bucks for that, or some money from grandma or something. You know, if you want to buy something that costs 100 bucks, you've got to save up for it. So, yep, 60% knock yourself out, do whatever. 20% save for something bigger. And then we've split the last 20, 10 and 10. We do 10% investing and 10% giving. And that's just our way of just trying to kind of make the point. He doesn't love the investing or the giving bit, by the way, at the moment, because it's just difficult and hard. Because you know you can't spend it, right? But that's the lesson we're trying to teach. It's with
that's
know.
The natural instinct. That's
of course it is.
Of course,
yeah.
That's the normal instinct. Exactly. If you're not upset by that, like
that's right. You're probably and sociopathic. You should, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it is a very. I found with my – sorry, I interrupted you, mate. I'll let you finish first.
Oh, well, okay. So very quickly, yeah, we do it slightly differently, but same kind of idea, mate, exactly as yours. We are doing – so investing goes two ways. We talked about this a little bit in the past. If you want to maximize their income, make it easy for them, get them on a train they can follow through their whole lives, ETFs are great. Because, like, you know, if you say you're a six-year-old doing this and they do it for the next 60 years with you know, 10% or 20% of their money – then it won't matter what they invest in terms of, you know, you might be able to earn a little bit more buying this share or that share, but you keep doing that, you're going to, I assume, do very, very well. You don't have any Australian exposure, by the way, so that might be something you might want to think about for them. International, excluding Australia, is the international ETF and the NASDAQ. So they don't have to have Australian stocks, but if you wanted to, you could have an Australian index being added to the mix somewhere. In terms of adding individual stocks, so there's two thoughts, as I said. Firstly, you know, just compound. They won't need anything more than that. If you develop these habits for them now, you know, just putting the money away and time are the two things that are going to massively outperform any stock picking they do. On the flip side, they can outperform over time if they do get good at stock picking. You know, I wouldn't discourage that. Also, too, if you're trying to kind of get them engaged with it, owning a bit of an ETF, ETF's hard to explain to a 40-year-old, let alone a 6-year-old. If you own shares in, I'll just pick some, I own shares in Disney, so I'll, you know, Disney or Woolies or Telstra or places.
Something you, visible.
Yeah, places you used, you shop. Microsoft, almost certainly. Right? If they're playing Minecraft, it's owned by Microsoft. Might be Nintendo if you've got a Nintendo games console. The stuff, not the stuff they can see and the stuff that they use. My older kid went through a Smiggle stage for a while, about 11 or 12. You know, that's just, you know, those things, so Premier Investments own Smiggle. If they're things they can kind of, not just see, but actually use themselves, it helps them think about a couple of things. Firstly, they're more interested because they see it's physical. Secondly, it helps them think about businesses as being an owner. There's something fun about saying, we own part of that. I say to my young bloke all the time when we get something from Amazon or, oh, he's got a fraction of a Woolies share in his little account. You know, and so I said, well, we made a little bit of money when we shopped at Woolies. So they kind of get the idea of shopping there. I also think like business owners, you know, why do they do that? What's in it for them? A different way of thinking about just rather than being a consumer, think about being a business owner. So there's really good value in owning individual stocks for that. Partly, as I said, if you want to outperform, partly just to kind of make investing more real. ETFs can be a bit vague, and telling a six-year-old that by the time they get 66, they'll have $1 million, they can't really get their head around $1 million or being 60. So something that just kind of takes them on that journey over time. I think my young bloke's Amazon shares are up like 77% since we bought. He's only got a tiny number of them, right? But he gets a kick out of that because he shops at Amazon and they're up, and that's all positive. So that's my thought.
He's got more money. He's got more money. Exactly. Yeah, he gets it.
He wants to take it out, by the way.
I bet he does.
Can I have it now? No, you can't have it now.
Yeah, I mean, but that's the point that I could take every kid under 10 and put them round the clock in my education camp of, you know, why delayed gratification matters, the power of time. It will be absolutely for naught. Some things you just have to experience to learn the lesson. Like you don't touch your hand on the stove more than once, kind of thing. And I've found this with my kids as well. It's just you can preach all day long, right? And I don't care. I want that.
They don't have the frontal lobe. It's just the human condition. It's not even.
It's all of us.
They can't do it. That's true.
I want now or later. Now, always now. But. When you sort of have the experience, and this is the thing that they'll notice, whether it's ETFs or direct shares, is like, yeah, one day, and you can't rush it. You can't force open the petals of a flower, as I like to say. It'll happen in due course when it needs to happen. And when it does happen, you get that, aha, that's really interesting. It's like, now do you see? Yeah, now I see. And no amount of theory and preparation and preaching is ever going to prepare you for that.
Correct.
And then you'll find that it can be very addicting. You know, it's like, huh. I want to do more of that, please. Can I take a dollar and turn it into more dollars without actually – you mean what do I have to do? Well, you have to wait. Do I have to do any work? No, you just have to wait. Like, okay, that becomes a pretty good deal. Yeah. And when the penny starts to drop and that you can make money by waiting is super, super, super powerful. I think it's just – even if you take investing out of the equation and you just think of it in terms of money. So, again, my kids – just useless, right? And with good money. Until we made it more about you can buy whatever you like. No rules. No rules whatsoever. But this is the money that you're going to get through doing a few jobs. And then you start doing that and they get some money and they go out and they spend it. And then they see something else that everyone's like, well, you have to work for it and earn more. And welcome to the real world, my friend. Welcome to the party. This is where we're all doing this. And again, that's a lesson that you can't teach. It's a lesson that you can only show. And then they realize that, well, I do want the bubble gum, but if I don't have the bubble gum and I don't have the whatever, maybe I can then get the earphones that I'm after or this or that. And they've done that a few times. And then you start to they really get that opportunity cost, which for me is just one of the most fundamental concepts in all of money and investing in life. Yeah. Everything is opportunity cost, right? And it's sort of like that. I just think you have to expose them to it in a little bit of a brutal way where it's kind of like, I won't stop you necessarily in spending that, but I will remind you that that could have been a different path.
Yeah,
and maybe this is just my kids because I just know that the preaching doesn't work for them. But they are and you can't rush it again. But as they get older, so our older one now really gets it, and he was useless for ages. And the little one's kind of just getting that, but again, it's because they've faced the consequence of their decisions. God, I sound like a bad parent, don't like a really harsh parent. Like you will learn through bitter experience how cruel this world
is.
That's
right. That's right. Daddy didn't become a pessimist by not trying hard, kids.
You know. So I mean, look, we spoil them stupidly at the same time, but I think I guess I come from the school of thought where it's sort of like, You need to let your children experience consequence to some degree because that's the only way that's how I learned. Yeah. My mum and dad told me plenty of stuff where I thought, right, whatever. Only later on do you realize that they're right. Yeah, right. And you get, because eventually you learn the consequence of your actions and you think that actually there's a path down here, there's a path down there. I can see exactly what's going to happen because I've gone through previous paths like that and I'll just make the better decision. Whereas this is why trust fund babies and those that are born to the ultra rich, they have no clue and why generational wealth is always lost and why they're always prats, frankly, because, you know, it's that old school, you don't know the value of a dollar. And it's like, no, you don't. And it is something that I think, even if I won Powerball next week, I would, you know, my kids would have to, I'm sure they'd get some toys, whatever, but I would still want them to get a job when they're old enough. I would still want them to have to face that dilemma that we all face when we go shopping. Is like, well, I do want that, but I also want this. Mm-hmm. Or do I want 10 times more than this in 10 years' time? Like, you know, you start running that analysis and it just, anyway, long rant over.
Can I quickly tangent and then we'll finish up Trent's question, ask another one. I was telling you before you recorded, I had some internet technicians at my house. I'm pretty sure I'm putting their kids through school. Got it fixed, which is all wonderful. And you know what's great? This is so incredibly nerdy. So I am a massive fan, no one will be surprised, of the Vanguard Index chart. And every year I write an article for our readers and members. Last year I think it was called Happy Index Chart Day, to those who celebrate kind of idea, which is just kind of fun. And I love doing it because it's just so incredibly powerful. Anyway, as a thank you, Vanguard sent me a framed Vanguard Index Chart poster. Which
did
up on,
they?
Yeah, and God love my wife, genuinely. She said, let's put it up in the house near where our young boy has his toys so he'll see it all the time, which is really cool of her.
That is cool.
So anyway, that's up on the wall. The techies come to fix the internet today. And then we're hanging around. The guy's like, is that chart serious? I was like, yeah. He said, so, and it shows this is the 2022 version. Mm-hmm. So it shows the US market was up from 10 to 180 grand. Australia was 10 to 130, something like that. It's like, so 10 grand, all I had to do was wait 30 years. And I was like, 180 grand. I was like, yeah. It's like 80 times my money. It's like, yeah. And it was just a really cool kind of, you know, there was two guys there. One was a very young, or much younger bloke. Other guy was, you know, younger than us, not much. And just having that conversation, it was one of those great moments of like, look at this. And that you see the penny drop. He's like, well, so maybe I should buy some shares then. I'm like, well, I can't give you advice, but you know, you can see what's here. You know, so what did you have to do to get that? Nothing.
You had to wait.
Right?
You had to not consume.
Exactly.
Back then, you had to delay that gratification and you had to wait. Yep.
Yeah. So those teachable moments happen at any point in life. And I guess that was it was a really, really cool example. I can't help myself. I love it when people kind of, you almost physically saw the penny drop. And it was just really cool. It was nothing other than a picture tells 1,000 words. That's the value.
The only downside with that is not that particular example, but the best advertisement for investing are bull markets, right? Because you notice it.
Yes.
But it's also unfortunate because it sets false expectation that it's always going to be like this.
Yeah.
And when you look backwards on the chart, you see the wobbles and the crashes, but they just don't look that bad in hindsight, you know? And you're not really braced for it. So unfortunately, you do get that buying at the worst time, selling at the worst time kind of phenomena. Yeah. Even though it's kind of important that people notice that, this is what happens. But I think I'm very quick to follow up with, but what that chart doesn't show you is a lot of wiggles and drawdowns along the way. Yes. But it's kind of also the point. This is like, well, that's why the return is better.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know. So don't not be excited. You're noticing what you need to notice, but just also understand that this isn't a cost. It isn't a free lunch, so to speak. Yeah. There is a cost that you must bear, not a financial cost. In fact, the financial return is positive, but it does place a cost on your soul.
Correct.
And not everyone's prepared to pay that cost.
That's what I said to him. I said, look, mate, you know, plenty of people do it because they like the chart. But look at these. Look at some of these big falls. I said, if you're going to do it, you have to know that you know you're not going to sell out and freak out when this happens. Because worse than not investing is investing, then losing money, then selling everything, never investing again. Yeah. You know, you've literally burnt money in the fireplace of life and walked away. You know, that. So just be mindful. It's exactly as you said. Those big falls, look at the COVID crash. Hardly notice it. Despite how big it was at the time, you know? So it's both those things. It's absolutely a reason to remember to stay invested when it happens, but you also don't want to understate how bad it's going to feel when it happens, because it looks little on a 30-year graph. It looks really, 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 really big in the month and a half or so that took to unfold.
Yeah. Hey, but look, just back to the question, I just think it's like, I'll make the comment again. It's like so many questions we get, they're all so right. Like we get to the point where we're really just discussing the finer points here. Right. Was it Trent who wrote it into us? But they like, brilliant. Like I got zero criticisms on what you're doing. So you can fine tune it. And you can find what works right for you. But I'm the last person who's going to say, nah, you need to go back to the drawing board. You're not even close. You're there. I think your kids will be very grateful for what you've done.
You're doing the job.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Speaking of things we haven't talked about or have talked about before, Ben sent us an email to take me to task. Hi boys, he says, I've been an avid listener of your podcast since day one and have recommended it to many mates who share my enthusiasm for your insightful discussions, /rants. Which is all lovely. And I think, that's really nice. Then he's going to go on to say I'm disappointed in, which always makes me sad. So I hope you're still going to stick with us, Ben. But he says, after listening to a recent episode, I felt compelled to reach out for the first time. I wanted to address Scott's comments about the YIMBY movement. Now, YIMBY being yes in my backyard, as an opposition to the not in my backyard or the NIMBY movement. Scott mentioned some reservations, Ben goes on, which surprised me given his past alignment with similar ideas. Before delving further, I should disclose I'm a member of Sydney YIMBY, which is an organisation, so my perspective may reflect a certain bias. So firstly, thank you for disclosing that, Ben. Super, super responsible and gold standard stuff. But also, we all bring our own biases, so that's okay. It's a bias if you're in YIMBY because you're in YIMBY because it's a bias, that's different. If you've objectively decided to join an organisation like that because you believe they're right, is it a bias? Kind of. It's a pre-decision or preconception, but it's not necessarily a bias in the same way. You shouldn't feel too bad about that. Ben says, I believe the crux of the issue is a lack of awareness about the legal barriers to medium density housing in many parts of Australia, enforced by local council zoning regulations. For example, in Sydney's Inner West Council, 43% is designated as heritage conservation area, severely limiting modifications to existing dwellings and inflating housing prices. The YIMBY movement, says Ben, advocates for allowing medium density housing in suitable areas near public transport and amenities. The issue is complex, but I believe it's solvable. The New South Wales government is taking steps to improve building regulations and is currently working up zoning areas near public transport hubs to address supply constraints. Successful upzoning initiatives like those in New Zealand have shown promise in both in moderating housing costs and increasing affordability. Ultimately, I believe our goals are aligned to promote affordable, sustainable and livable homes for all Australians. I hope this clarifies what the YIMBY movement is trying to achieve. Cheers, Ben. That's a very, very thoughtful and well put argument. I'll just throw it to you first, mate. Any thoughts, comments, suggestions, ideas?
Yeah. I'm not too close to the specific movements themselves. I'm going to be embarrassed myself here. I thought the NIMBY YIMBY thing was more of a general description of a certain stance as opposed to more organised movements. So that's how
NIMBY wasn't, but YIMBY have kind of made themselves an all movement to kind of combat what they see as the NIMBYism that's doing bad things.
Okay.
The YIMBY groups have kind of sprung up around the country.
Okay, cool. I mean, they've got a point, right? I mean, both sides have a point. Like, I do not want to see beautiful old houses all torn down and replaced with 40-foot Meriton skyscrapers. I shouldn't mention brands. Certain, you know, skyscrapers probably aren't built that well and allegedly just going to be you know, future slums. Like, but at the same time, it's like, we can't all expect quarter-acre blocks in the inner west of Sydney. You know, that might be a little bit naive. I know my brother did some renovations a few years back in an area, and they brought in the heritage laws just recently. So virtually every house on the street had been just McMansionized. It's just disgusting, right? But they had to keep some like semblance of their original one, which was, and it wasn't a special house. It wasn't no significance. It's just that before and after the fact. And it's kind of like a little bit too heavy handed on that. Like the horse had bolted and it's like, really? We have to, and nothing else is done. And actually, anyway, it's kind of, you see this come up again and again, and it's just like, there's a middle path here.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that there are two sides here sort of arguing the toss, because probably both are wrong in the extreme.
Yeah, that's right.
You know?
Yeah. You get better results when you take a bit from everything and kind of, yeah. But for those who are prepared to understand and accept different ideas or build on their own ideas, that's where progress happens, right?
Yep, absolutely. I mean, I do think councils are often too much in the pocket of developers. It seems to be that the debate is ultra high density or three bedroom houses, and that's the debate. And I'm like, well, can we have a set of there was a couple of examples where I used to live. Well, I was in the inner west, and you know, they're the exception to the rule, but there are some lovely little townhouse estates. It might be six sort of houses, three bedroom sort of size thing, two story. You know, not huge, but it wasn't just a massive block of two-bedroom units. And people had garages and stuff. And that's a middle path, again, where you don't have to go up into the sky and put massive extra stress onto the roads and the resources and stuff. But it's certainly where once there was like two families living, now you've got five times that amount, right? And there's a good argument, I think, for just sort of recognizing the realities of the situation and needing to address it. And we don't have to like go to one extreme to solve it. We can, but I don't know. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally makes sense.
It's so vague though. It's like an aspirational statement from me. I've got no specific solutions here.
Oh, that's why this is so hard though, right? I think, so Ben, I've been pretty clear, mate. I've also been pretty clear on Twitter. So if you want to jump on there, you may not want to. If you don't love what I'm talking about, what strikes me is I have no issue with medium and high density, frankly. If that's what the people live in the area want, and if that's what the people looking for housing want, my view is, I guess, a bit collectivist in nature, which is, I think you know, I'm a member. I live in my house, but I'm a member of my community, whether that's street, suburb, you know, region, whatever. And I think my personal amenity and hopefully amenity of all those people who live around me is kind of commingled in terms of the decisions that we all make about what we want our areas to look like and be like. And so I don't think that's unreasonable. I think there's a reasonable degree of absolute ownership of your own home and kind of, you know, collective ownership or collective responsibility for the broader environment. And that includes everything from, you know, the look and feel of streetscapes to rubbish. And, you know, there is some idea of actually community is a good thing. And I think there's some value in recognizing and appreciating what a community wants from their community. Now, the challenge I guess I have is a couple fold. I feel like YIMBY is a bit of a ambulance at the bottom of the hill rather than a fence at the top. which is, well, bugger, look how bad things are, and they're kind of getting worse. We really need to find a way to fix this. As opposed to, hey, let's address some of the core issues that are causing this to need to be an issue, right? So why are we tearing down potentially heritage listed, whether they're deserved or not, and putting up medium density? If it's because someone wants a townhouse and you want to build a townhouse and they want to live in the townhouse and the townhouse is nice in that area, then great. We should absolutely. I'm not against medium density in the slightest. If that's what people genuinely want, free of this is all I can afford or this is the only place I can live or whatever else. If they genuinely want that, then great. Let's do more of it and let's give people the opportunity to do that. I am not a big on heritage grounds. I really don't have that much of an issue other than Ram's point. Eyesores aren't good for anybody, but I don't really care as much about that. Cameron Kusher is, I think he works for Seek. I don't know. Maybe he doesn't. I shouldn't. Anyway, on Twitter. He tweeted this, and this is kind of encapsulates, you know, sometimes people tweet and like, oh, I wish I'd said that. He said, quote, "It's an odd one that when the world is progressing, we expect young people, some willingly, some not, to live in higher density, smaller and worse quality dwellings than their parents." And that's kind of my starting point. You know, at a national, state, regional, community level, I'm kind of like, you know what, if we were part of a cohesive community and one of our members of the community said, look, I'd really like a house that's like this. And we could say, well, you can't have that. Now, if they want a 10-bedroom mansion, no one has a 10-bedroom mansion. But they say, look, I'd like a house with a backyard, please. And our answer is, you can't, because we have engineered a society, continue to engineer a society in which that choice can't be made because of whether it's transport or population or infrastructure or whatever reasons, you may not have that. You may only have, or you can afford, all I'm going to provide within some distance of wherever you want to be is a 2-bedroom shoebox built by a company we won't talk about, that might start with M and rhyme with Ayrton. That's kind of at a really, really basic starting point. If we are making policy decisions that force those choices on people because that's all they can afford, that's my issue. Or when we say, you know, would medium density housing more affordable? Well, I guess in the sense that it's more affordable to buy a 2-bedroom unit than a 3-bedroom house. So yeah, more of those. So it's more affordable. So we fixed it. You don't really fix it. You just make them choose by either directly or indirectly that option because that's all they can choose. Now, again, plenty of people would say, well, that's better than the fact I can't afford a house at all right now. And I agree with that. So let's not hold them out of that sort of space. But my argument is a starting point of like, well, if my kids, your kids, would like a certain degree of amenity in their dwellings, we have every possibility option to do that. And so I'm not a NIMBY or a YIMBY. Let's actually work out what country we want to live in and what we want it to look like and feel like and be like and what opportunities. And you know, we talk about policy stuff all the time. This is just another one of those, which is how would you set up, let's pick Sydney because you're in the Inner West. Ram was. I used to live there, not the Inner West, but I did actually for a while. You know, if the reality is that to live within X distance of the CBD or to be able to afford a house at all or a dwelling at all, I've got to have a 2-bedroom unit because that's all that's available to me and all I can afford because of pricing pressures and development costs and population growth and everything else. I don't know. I feel like when you start from that position rather than starting from, well, maybe we can do some other things. Ben, I don't mean this critically of you or the movement at all generally, but I think if you're going to try and address these issues, what I struggle with is the acceptance of the inputs to the problem being either unresolvable or no effort putting into resolving them. There is a pragmatism to that, and I appreciate the pragmatism of if we're going to have this many people, we should find the best way to house them. I think that's perfectly fine. I struggle with the starting point, which says, I will assume these things are unchangeable, but I think these things are changeable, so I'll change these things. You know, if I said fix the housing crisis and your answer is YIMBY, I don't think that takes full account of all of the inputs, I suppose, to the issue. So that's why I have an issue with the YIMBYism as a broader concept, not with individuals at all or people trying to make a genuine improvement. It's just that starting point of people want to live there, great. Let's build a house they want to live in, or dwellings, homes, units, townhouses they want to live in. Great. I think it's awesome. And we should do that. If we cannot meaningfully impact the amenity of people who already live there, because why should my desire or need to live in a, you know, one place impact yours if you already live there? I don't know. I don't reckon I should be putting that on you. I've got no dog in the fight, by the way. I live in regional New South Wales. There is no risk of me being YIMBYed or NIMBYed here. So it's not going to affect me at all. I've got no dog in the fight. But nationally, at a national level, and for frankly my kids and other people's kids, I don't think, as Cameron says, that the phrase, you know, we expect people, some willingly, some not, to live in higher density, smaller and worse quality dwellings than their parents. It just strikes me as a societal failing if the best we can offer them is, well, here's something we made for you from knocking down an old place and putting up two new ones that are smaller. I'm not sure that's a win societally, I suppose. Does that make sense, Ram?
Yeah, it does. I mean, again, I'm not close enough to the movement to know, but I suspect the retort there would be, well, it's not a silver bullet, but yeah. enabling more flexibility in planning and approvals will move the dial, right?
Yep.
Like it's
totally.
I'd have sympathy with that approach, in fact. You've got to strike a balance because I wouldn't want to buy a house in a nice leafy suburb and then next day wake up with a massive tower above me. And it's like, well, no one told me this. So I think usually what's best in, and this is really what councils, government should be doing here is, and businesses is all the time. It's like, well, whatever you're going to do, do it. But we want certainty
exactly.
more than anything else.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that once you've got certain more clear parameters on what things are likely to be like, then everyone can work. I think if your aspiration is to live in Glebe or somewhere, if you're lucky enough to afford it now coming in fresh, and you know, some of these kinds of places, I don't know if you can expect, you know, a 5-acre lot with horses running around, like, you know, just take a stupid example here. You kind of like you're signing up to higher density housing
and
if it gets slightly more dense, but that helps in aggregate sort of, if it happens in a lot of places, solve the issue, then And I think it's anecdotally and that may be the wrong way to approach it, but I know that when we've been looking around, that's really the choice you've got. You've got to really pay up and get the 3-bedroom brick house or you get the unit. There's very little option in between. And so I think with Yimby sort of saying, well, come on, let's be a little bit more relaxed on things. Let's understand that a compromise is required. Let's understand that it's not a cure-all, but it does help shift things, at least move some things in. It helps address the problem.
Yeah.
But I've got sympathy for that, I think.
Yeah, I like that. That's reasonable. Hey, let's finish with a question from an anonymous listener who says, hello, Scott, and the man who runs that premium private investing club, I can't remember. I think you're thinking about Andrew Rampage, anonymous. I am just wondering, he says, why people who have equity in their primary place of residence don't take a loan out against the house but buy broad-based ETFs as an investment. I'm not sure what the point would be of having equity in your own home and investing in the stock market with your hard-earned personal money. I could just be missing the point. Please help me out. Ram?
Yeah. No, I mean, I've got sympathy for that. I mean, borrow money in a depreciating asset, use it to buy, you know. Oh, sorry. Use a depreciating asset, i.e. the currency, to buy something that's going to appreciate. If I can borrow against my house at 5% and I can get a 10% return, it feels like money for Jam. I 100% get it. It makes perfect sense. Of course, the trouble is that where you draw that line, you know, maybe that funding cost is much more than you thought. Maybe the return that you were going to get is much less than you thought. So you can't argue against the proposition with a certain set of assumptions, but just be careful on what assumptions you're using. Now, the response, but I'm just, if I just use averages and I have a huge buffer and it's not too excessive, then I see that now. Actually, I think I was pretty late to this realization. I've always been very anti-debt. And I look at myself now and later in life and go, no, there's good debt and bad debt, right? And good debt, I would argue, is used to buy things that are going to give you greater, they're going to grow far more than any cost you have to bear to sort of borrow that kind of, it just seems like it's shorting the dollar is effectively what you're doing. So I'm gonna take my value, which is I've worked for and I've saved up value in this currency. I can leave it there in the bank. I can print it up or get it out of the ATM, put it under the mattress, or I can put it in this thing, which is going to be the better proposition. It's like, well, I know that this thing, even as designed, is going to go down 2-3% in value each. I'm going to buy something with it. And if I can get very safe debt that's not going to be margin called and is going to be very conservatively geared, yeah, you should do that. I wish I'd done it, you're right. Like not aggressively, but I wish I had done that. I think I was far more robust and bulletproof in my financial situation, but probably too much so. There's a fine line that you walk. And do you see where I'm getting at here? Like it feels like the proper responsible response I should have here is no, that's reckless. I don't know if it is. It's a question of degrees, I think, is the point I would make. And at a point, yes, it's stupid, but I don't know if it is stupid. In fact, I actually think it's probably sensible at a modest degree. Am I wrong?
I don't think so. I don't think I'm not sure I'm getting the analogy entirely, because I don't think it's a case of cash in the bank versus investing.
But if
your house increases in value, it's not the same as cash that's depreciating. So if you've got a house that's growing in value, the cash isn't cash until you borrow it or somehow remove it from
the house. But you're borrowing that cash that you borrow. You'll be paying, like someone who borrowed $1 million in 1980, that was a big loan. You know, it's not that big a loan these days to sort of pay back. But those loans that are written over generally 30-year periods, you're paying it back with money that's not worth any. Let's not get crazy here. Just like 2% inflation from here into infinity. It's like I'm paying that loan back with dollars that aren't worth anywhere over a 30-year time frame. Not even close. Yeah. So it makes sense in that scenario. The only use for cash is for transactions, really. And in all other cases, I minimize my exposure to it.
Yeah. I suppose.
We talk about that all the time. And I've heard you say, and I know you don't. And why would you? Why would you have any money in cash at the age that you're at? The only reason I've got a big purchase coming up. Yeah. I want to buy a house or put a deposit on a house in the not too distant future. Or I'm at an age where it's just like I don't need the return. I just want to make sure there's no volatility. I mean, other than that, it's madness to have cash.
But again, he's not saying he would have cash. Sorry.
But he has very easy, low risk access to cash. And very cheap in real terms, nominally defined in real terms over the tenure of the loan. So there's a subtlety there.
Yeah, you effectively got, even with the equity, assuming your house goes up at some point in value and or the shares go up in value, the asset you've swapped the debt for increases while the debt doesn't.
Yeah, it's more the debt. So you've got to treat it, it's not even about the house price itself. If you've got the collateral just to make sure that that debt is never called, whether it goes up or not, it's just sort of like I will never get forcibly called on this debt. And I can then extract cash from that and use that cash that will earn me a higher rate of return than what it cost me to borrow that cash. Mm-hmm. You know, now if I'm going to maybe get an 8% return and it's going to cost me 7%, you know, this is very marginal and maybe that's, things can go wrong very quickly, but I do think what's the standard variable right now? I don't know, like 6-something%, 6.2. Yeah, there you go. And if I feel reasonably confident that I can get a 10-11% return on average in the market, I'd be like, it's not crazy, right?
No, it's not crazy. I'm more conservative than you, I think, in this context. And I kind of end up saying the same things or using the same language, but effectively it's a behavioral question, not a rational question. Mm, mm. You're about to say, I've said many times, if I could borrow my next 40 years worth of investment contributions non-callable at a decent rate, I would do it tomorrow. And that absolutely remains true. So the behavioral stuff comes in for a few reasons, I suppose. It assumes you're investing correctly or sensibly. It assumes that you're right in your investment choices. Mm-hmm. It assumes that you still don't get hit with some sort of Great Depression-style decline. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm the last person to predict that or think it's going to happen, but I'm also the last person that can't happen because it has. Mm. So, you know, at some point you borrow, I know you take $500,000 out of your residence, you invest it in shares and it falls 10, 20, 30, 40, 50%. Mm-hmm. And again, if it comes back, is it a problem? No. If you, as you said before, mate, you buy at the wrong time, sell at the wrong time, here's what it does. It opens up your life to more fragility, to more risk, to a greater chance of something going wrong. As Warren Buffett has said, and I've said many times, quote, leverage is the only way a smart guy can go broke, end quote. And so you're kind of saying, well, hang on, I'm in front here. I'm achieving my financial goals. I'm going to make my financial circumstances more precarious. So let me throw another Buffettism in. He talked about people betting what they have and need for what they don't have and don't need. Mm-hmm. In other words, you know, you got $1 million. I could bet half of that and see if I can make some money on it. It's like, well, hang on, you've got $1 million. Like, what? Why would you bet any of that? What, you know, why would you take that risk in terms of some sort of preservation or some sort of preparedness for not going back to square one, to make your life less fragile. The upside of making more money is great, but the downside of losing that is far more, the same amount of money. It's never, again, we'll use asymmetrical. It's never a symmetric thing. The amount of money you gain or lose could be entirely symmetric, but the impact on your life, you know, if I had $1 million and I had a 50% chance of winning $1 million and 50% of losing $1 million, that's in theory, you know, the same bet.
Yep.
Right? But the impact on my life of going to zero or going to $2 million, they are very, very, very different outcomes. And while I'd like to go from a million to two, I don't ever, ever, ever want to go from a million to zero. Now, again, you're not saying that. I'm not saying
it's a question. It's a question of degrees.
It is a question of degrees and a question of that. You know, I'm just, I'm not risk averse at all, actually, but I'm stability risk averse. what if there's going to be a better phrase for that, you know? But the idea of like, do I want to take that risk? Even if the odds are small, even if the odds are tiny, Buffett talks about if you had a gun and a million chambers, he still wouldn't play Russian roulette. The chance of you killing yourself are tiny, but the output of that, the response, like that's still not worth doing, right? So that's kind of the way I think about it.
There's no right or wrong here. It depends.
Correct.
But let me give you a slightly different hypothetical just to see where you land personally. Yeah. You've got $1 million house and it's paid off.
Yes.
Right?
Thank you.
Wouldn't it be nice, wouldn't it? And you could borrow against that at 6%.
Yep.
Would you consider taking on, like drawing down 10% of your equity, for example, at 6.5%, knowing that, you know, you've been in this business for a while? I assume that you think you could probably get a better long-term average return than that.
Yep.
Would you do that? And one thing I'll say before I let you answer is that what's really the worst case scenario of that? Yeah. I'll let you answer, but I suspect you've got to go, yeah, I'd consider that.
It's why I talked about the behavioral stuff, mate, and I'm absolutely talking about both sides of my mouth. I would do it. I would do it. Well,
I'm sure you'd do it, right?
Yeah, I did. But would I? I mean, let's say.
Why wouldn't you?
Well, because let's say I paid the house off.
It's free money.
But I've paid the house off, right? So at some point, I'm like, well, I have the psychic emotional benefit of having the house paid off. No one can take the house away. It should have been confiscated by government for, you know, horribly doing something that I've done badly and I get fined something. It's mine.
You're only going to lose it. In this scenario, it's got to drop 90% before you've wiped out your equity, right?
But it's just the loan itself. At some point in the accumulation of wealth, you kind of go, it's a ratchet. You tick that off and you move forward. And so, it's a good question you ask, actually, mate. I'm thinking about it because I'm thinking at that point, Do I go and remortgage the house? And I honestly don't know. I don't know, mate. I don't know that I will. I don't know. Would you?
Yeah. I mean, if we were talking about 80%, free money.
But it's on your numbers. It's $3,000 a year. You borrow $1,000, $100,000.
$3,000. I didn't have. And
you got to get a loan over your house.
I guess I would say it. Yes, but the risk is so. Like if house prices are falling 90%, there are some serious things I need to worry about other than my investment.
I wouldn't do it because I'm worried about getting wiped out. I would do it because my financial strategy is to accumulate assets, not to accumulate debt. I just have no interest in being clever or smart or fancy for the sake of, theoretically, would I do it? Yes. Yeah. Am I actually going to do it? I don't think so. I really honestly think I'll go, great. Land title, back pocket, job done. Let's move on to the portfolio. I don't think I would. Rationally, is it smart to do? To your point, yeah. Would I remortgage the house?
So someone pointed this out to me recently. And it was such a good point. Why does Coca-Cola have debt on its balance sheet? There are companies out there that have been around for decades that are as bulletproof as bulletproof can be, you know, and even if they are going to die, it's going to be a very slow decline. Yeah. Like Coke is a great example of this, right?
Yep.
They don't need debt. They could entirely run without it, but they do because I think the boffins have just worked out. It's like this is a much smarter move. Now, the conversations get difficult because it gets it gets very black and white and binary because, yeah. And obviously that'd be a dumb thing for Coke to do if its debt to equity ratio is 300% on it. Yeah. Like you're going to wipe because all of those things become real. But then when you slide that slider across, you get to the point where it's just sort of like, this is the rational thing to do and the smart thing to do because the risk is virtually non-existent. And the upside is sufficient to justify the additional effort or work or thinking that goes into it. And even if you want to take the principle, well, I'm rich enough and I don't need anymore, it's like, well, then you've got more money to give to charity or you've got more, like I feel as though there might just be a point where I just don't care because I've got other priorities in life. It's like, yep, totally get that. But if it's not 10% for you, is it 5%? Is it 3%? At which point are you saying, and even if you say, well, the upside for me each year is like $300,
yep.
It's like, well, it's $300 you didn't have. You know what I mean?
But
it's money for jam.
I wouldn't trade the holding the asset free and clear. So I'll take your Coca-Cola, and because we haven't mentioned Buffett anywhere near enough times yet, I'll raise your Berkshire.
Yeah.
Which simply chooses to have no debt. And 100 million, yep. It chooses to be that business. Now, Buffett, imagine how much Buffett would be worth. But imagine how much Buffett would be worth if he'd mortgaged half of Berkshire for the last 55 years, right?
I reckon he'd be worth more.
That's what I'm saying. I agree with you. Yeah. But my point is he doesn't need to, hasn't needed to, and sees the chance that if something goes badly, I don't want to be holding, there's just no, the upside for him psychically, emotionally, financially, isn't enough to take the downside. So I'm glad you asked me the question because
it's a perfectly valid point you make.
Yeah, but while I said I would borrow the money now, and I would, I'd actually, and this is it's all purely psychological, right? I'd borrow $1 million against a non-callable ETF tomorrow.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I wouldn't borrow $1 million against the house tomorrow for the same.
I guess I would treat that as non-callable as well. In essence, practicality.
No, you're right, but that's why I'm separating them. I'm literally separating them and saying, despite that, I wouldn't use my house as security for the debt.
Right.
This is going to sound like I'm being critical or pejorative. I'm not. I'm not greedy enough to say I will take the extra money and mortgage the house. If I'm $1 million house free and clear, I'm like back pocket. Cool. That's I'm in the monopoly game, right? I'm accumulating the asset, right?
Mm-hmm.
Asset accumulated. Let's move on to the next one. Could I give more money to charity? Yeah, but then the loan's going to be paid off in my estate anyway. Mm. You know, it's at some point, I just don't want to be that clever or that tricky. It's not even that clever or tricky. I'm happy to go, you know, good, done that job. Let's move on from there.
Yeah. There's no wrong answers, right?
Yeah, exactly,
it's a personal thing.
Yeah.
To what degree do you place that psychological benefit?
100%.
What degree of benefit, you know?
Yeah.
And then some people say not much. Others will say a lot. And then that's your answer. But I guess to the questioner's question, it's like, in theory, I don't see anything wrong with it. But just provided that you understand that there is a line at some point you cross, which it goes from rational to irrational.
Yes. And I'm being equally irrational by not doing it. By the way, I'm 1,000,000%. Comfortable with that. Like that's the personal psychological emotional choice, which is just, you know, and I think you're right, mate. I think your point of if you are a very rational person and you know you can withstand the slings and arrows of the market, then I have no problem with that strategy. I don't, would you borrow at 6.5 now? My only question would be what margin of safety would you give yourself? I expect the market would do 9. If I'm borrowing at 6.5, I guess it's deductible things taxable. So there's still probably the same margin. Would I do it for 3%? Again, because it's free money if it happens, but you don't know it's going to happen.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd borrow $1 million to buy an ETF portfolio today at 6.5. I'm very sure I would do it at 4.5.
Yes.
And it's just gut feel. In between, I don't know where the cutoff would be for me. I wouldn't lock in 6.5 for 30 years, I don't think. I expect to do well anyway, but I don't know that I'd be so comfortable that the margin of safety was sufficient. I'd probably lock in 5.
There is a lot to be said for the certainty of being fixed for 30 years at the same time.
Yes,
so that's a really good, interesting, that's a good question as well. Like, yes, you're right. If it's not 6.5, is it 7? Is it 7.5? Yeah. I mean, yeah, where's the line that you cross? It's an excellent point.
Yeah.
And 4.5% is very different from 6.5. Like 4.5%, absolutely. Like, how could you not? Especially if you felt like interest rates were going to fall down and all of that kind of stuff. But if that's all that was on the table was 6.5%, but at least it was locked. Like, no matter what, I know exactly what I'm going to pay. I think I would still take it over a 30-year time frame because I don't think I have to be Warren Buffett to get 9% or 8.5%.
Sure, the market does what it's supposed to do, though. I mean, there's always the, you know.
I mean, that's the risk.
It also depends on what you've got to – it depends also how you've got to fund it, right? If you can if you don't need the interest or the dividends or the gains to fund the loan –
yeah.
Again, so we've got some timing issues there. If I could, if I could have no call and no interest payable, for example, and I could pay the interest at the end of 30 years after the proceeds, that's easy.
Oh, that's different.
Or if I had the money in my own personal, if I was earning enough to pay to fund the interest, that's cool too. Yeah. But if I had to every single year find the difference, a couple of bad years in a row early on, I'm not sure it's terminal, but it's meaningfully terrible. If you had a couple, you know, if you didn't invest, I guess if it's an ETF, maybe you get 4% yield, so maybe it helps if it's a straight ETF. But you know, you can imagine a couple of years where you're getting 4% dividend. You know, COVID years, right? The banks cut the dividends. I don't know what it did to the average yield of the ASX. Maybe it's 3.5. The market's down 15% or something, and all of a sudden you're like, hang on, I've got to sell at 15% to fund the gap between the dividends and the interest payments. I don't, again, if the reverse could also be true. If the market jumps 25% your first year, you never got a problem again. But yeah, it's an interesting kind of thought experiment.
It does. It's the assumptions. Timing matters, and what return are you going to get? You know, you get 20% per annum over the next 30 years, you know, borrow at 10-15%, whatever. It still makes sense. But I do think a reasonable person and the listener said, right, it's like if it was a broad-based Vanguard low-cost index ETF, I'm just going to thumb suck that over a 30-year period, that'll be close to what the last 30 years has been. Or maybe I'll add a margin of safety and just say, I don't know, 8.5% to that kind of stuff. And I'm guaranteed 6.5%. That's the proposition in front of you. Very, very low risk, 2% return net. I think it's reasonable.
You'd take 6.5?
Yeah, I think I would. I think I would, because I don't have to shoot the lights out, right, to make that worthwhile. And if, let's say I'm wrong and the market delivers me a compounded 6.5% over 30 years. By the way, that's a disappointing outcome. I can't imagine it's a world that's been as prosperous as it should be. But I haven't lost any money. Like, it's a wash, you know, even at that really disappointing kind of level. Yeah. So for me, and then even if it's a little bit of a loss, it's guys disappointing. But this is, we talk about asymmetry again. It's sort of like, how bad does this, do my returns in the world have to be for this not to make sense? And even if it's just average and not even good, it's going to work out really well. So it's like pretty good chance of getting an okay return. Small chance of getting a very negligible return, or an even smaller chance of a lot. Like, it just feels like I'm not betting the farm here. And you and I can have a discussion in 30 years, and no one's going to go, "You idiot! That was such a dumb thing to do. You ruined your family." So I like, probably didn't need to do that. Yeah, you're right. But it hasn't cost me anything.
No, I agree.
But there's probably a greater probability of where it's like, well, it wasn't great, but I got 2% free on 100 or 200 grand over the last 30 years. It's like, I'll take it.
To the extent it's free, it's not even 2%. It's just literally free money, right?
I mean, it's literally free.
When they line up, but the capital base doesn't matter, which sounds stupid to say. Yeah. We're talking about extremes, and I'm generalizing. If it was an absolute guarantee of the cost of funding and the return, and neither of those are guaranteed, right? They could go in any different direction. But it's a bit like, you know, if you borrow 100% of a house purchase, when you sell it, what's your return? Well, it's infinite because I didn't put anything down. If you borrow 100% of the value of any portfolio, I mean, it has a nominal value when you buy it, but if it's all borrowed money, your equity is zero. Mm-hmm. And so the gain is infinite, which is even better than, to your point, the 2% is like, well, it's just whatever the dollar value is. If it's, you know, $2,000 a year on $1 million, it doesn't really matter what the base is. You're getting $2,000 a year for nothing. It's like that's, you know, someone's just giving you a stipend from the long lost uncle, Monopoly style, you know, Pasco click $200. That's literally what you're doing every year.
Yep.
It's beautiful from that perspective.
We're talking about here is banks' business model, right?
Well, that's
I'm going to take this money and then I'm going to lend it there. I'm going to make a net interest margin.
We're talking about CBA and stuff on Friday. I wasn't going to go there to prolong the thing, but you're exactly right. That's it. And it's risk management. It's literally what they do. Yeah. Now you got to again think about: are you borrowing long or borrowing short? Are you matching your durations? Are you matching your risk profiles? That's exactly what they do. Which is also why I find it so incredibly fascinating that banks won't provide non-callable margin loans because they've seen the long-term history of this stuff. And I know it's not cash. And I know economic. The reason they don't do it is because finance orthodoxy says shares are risky and cash isn't. Mm-hmm. So they would say, well, hang on, I'm putting non-risk cash against a risky asset. Why would I do that for nothing or not be able to call it back? But the reality of the long-term, you know, they could handcuff me. They literally handcuff me. Mm-hmm. You can't touch this for 30 years. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll still do it. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but it's going to cost this. I'll still do it. You know, they could set the conditions as long as the durations are matched and I get to choose the investments.
Yeah.
And again, I'd happy to do ETFs if that's what the bank said. Okay, you don't want to be picked stocks, fine. ASX got to be global, fine. You know, you call the numbers. I can't imagine in what scenario I wouldn't be happy with that kind of outcome if I was given that choice because it's just money for jam. But again, you come full circle. So, well, hang on, why wouldn't the banks do it themselves? And that's kind of that really starts to mess with your head because, you know, where's the bank's capital best employed in lending for houses or buying shares? I mean, that was, speaking of Buffett, that's his entire business model. He took the insurance float and said, I can leave it in cash or I could buy little pieces of businesses that are generating cash with it. Mm-hmm. That's literally the genesis of the entire idea. Both for Berkshire as the original mill where you said, well, I'll take the excess cash and do that rather than reinvesting in the mill. And then insurance where it was genuinely, give me your money, I'll invest for 12 months and give you back what you need. I'll keep the difference. That's not banking, but it's not miles off.
Yep. I mean, it's just really deep at a level because I want money and I want my money to make more money.
That's right.
And well, how does money make money? Well, because I take it and I buy something with it and that thing becomes more and I pay it back. But it's just like there's a lot of leaps of faith that in all of this kind of stuff. This is why we have credit booms and busts and the rest of it. Because hey, here's money. Oh, there's money everywhere. I'm going to use it. I'm going to 3% yield over here and a 10% yield over there and I can do all this kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, that yield has to come from somewhere. It's one of the things you must always ask as an investor, where does the yield come from? And it can only sustainably come from genuine value creation. And that's why money itself is never going to make money. So you've really got to, it's a shell game. I've got to convert this money, which is what money's for, into something that will generate value.
Yeah.
And then once it's generated said value, I can then convert it back for more money. That's where the yield comes from in that particular instance, when it's played out well.
That's right.
But if it doesn't, because I bought a bunch of monkey NFTs and turns out that it didn't create any value for anyone and it all, I can't flog it off to anyone else. That's where it all comes undone. And there's like the yield that was expected does not come to fruition. But what you want to know, and I think what the genesis of all of the launching off of this sort of discussion is like, if I do have money and I don't want to spend it now and I don't want to spend it for a while, I really don't want to keep it in money because I know it's just going to melt away. And if I've got something that I can convert a small amount into money, but then convert that again into another really high quality asset. You're moving pieces around here, but it's the pieces that you control that really, really matter.
Yes.
And money is really just, if you can get, this is another reason why big companies have such a big competitive advantage. If you can get easy, cheap access to capital, it's a superpower, right? Because money doesn't make money in and of itself, but money enables the creation of money via the value creation mechanism, if I'm not going too deep. And if you can get that part right and you're backing the things that will create value, and if you're backing an index, you're probably just banking on the wider economy creating value, which is not a terrible bet. It all has a certain elegance and logic to it. It feels very financial engineering. Fancy, and it can be, and when taken to a certain extreme, it almost always is. And when it's malinvested and all of that kind of stuff, it's always a disaster. But again, I've got a real tangible asset here in my property. I've got oodles of equity. There's something else over here that is, of quality and generating value. And you're saying I can take some of the value locked up in this and put it over into that. There's going to be a cost, but the cost will be far less than the potential return. It just makes sense to me. Again, at a point.
I like it. We need to finish. I've rethought my answer. I would, because I don't want to be in the hypothetical, because I don't want to be pushed out of an asset when it's cheap to fund the interest cost, I would probably want to borrow. I would cap my, and this is not your answer, which is fine. Mm-hmm. I would cap my borrowing rate at roughly, if not tiny bit above, the likely income yield.
Mm.
Because that way I know I can make
services itself. You get the capital.
Yeah, right. And and maybe that's too greedy. But in terms of if you've got to sell parts of the capital to fund the debt or to fund the interest on the debt, you are at the mercy of the market too significantly. Given that while you're getting 2% on average every year, some years are plus 10 and some years are minus 15. Mm. I don't think I'd want to make a bet at a single starting point, because again, if it goes down the first year or first couple of years. You're behind the eight ball for a very long time trying to make that back and then get ahead of the game.
Mm,
So I think I'd probably say I'd probably want the interest rate to be roughly the dividend yield, more or less.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah. Yeah.
And Frank Red's top on that, by the way. It
does.
Speaking of which, that gives you an extra bit of buffer. So maybe 6.5? No, 5.5. There you go.
But the point is there is a point.
Yes,
and that's the number that really rounds out the conversation because there is no yes or no. Yes, you should. No, you shouldn't.
Well, here's the other thing, though. By the way, if it's truly cost free, then why not borrow $20 million or $100 million?
Yeah, exactly.
At some point, that's what blows your mind. There is no limit to that because there's no equity required, which is also just weird.
Absolutely.
Should we finish this podcast?
You probably should.
mate, I appreciate you spending some more extra time with me this weekend. We are, as I said, we've pre-recorded a couple for next week, but please hit us up, info@fool.com.au, if you have any questions, or on any of the socials. Ram is at strawmaninvest or at @sage_Simeon. I'm at @TMFScottP or Scott Phillips Money on Facebook. As always, in both cases, please look out for imitators. Use the handle or check the handles. I've had some more imitators this week. So just be careful. Neither of us are going to try and sell you Bitcoin, even though Ram loves it. And if you get friend requests from us out of the blue, it's not going to be us. So just be careful with that.
Yeah.
Make sure you check the handles or any accounts because it's happening, unfortunately, right now.
Or just basically, you said, if one of us are contacting you with an opportunity, it's not us.
It's not us. In which case, we'll see you next Friday and full on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.